Chapter 3. The next morning the correctives had fallen off, and the bruising on Cyverdon's face had faded. She seemed comfortable, but she still seemed high, so that was hardly surprising. I unrolled the bundle of clothes I had bought for her, insulated underclothes, quilted shirt and trousers, undercoat and hooded overcoat, gloves, and laid them out. Then I took her chin and turned her head toward me. "Can you hear me?" "Yes." Her dark brown eyes stared somewhere distant over my left shoulder. "Get up." I tugged on her arm, and she blinked lazily and got as far as sitting up before the impulse deserted her. But I managed to dress her in fits and starts, and then I stowed what few things were still out, shouldered my pack, took Cyverdon by the arm, and left. There was a flyer rental at the edge of town. Unpredictably, the proprietor wouldn't rent to me unless I put down twice the advertised deposit. I told her I intended to fly northwest, to visit a herding camp, an outright lie which she likely knew.
"You're an off-worlder," she said. "You don't know what it's like away from the towns. Off-worlders are always flying out to herding camps and getting lost. Sometimes we find them again, sometimes not."
I said nothing.
"You'll lose my flyer, and then where'll I be? Out in the snow with my starving children, that's where."
Beside me, Cyverdon stared vaguely off into the distance. I was forced to put down the money. I had a strong suspicion I would never see it again. Then the proprietor demanded extra, because I couldn't display a local pilot certification, something I knew wasn't required. If it had been, I would have forged one before I came. In the end, though, she gave me the flyer. I checked its engine, which seemed clean and in good repair, and made sure of the fuel. When I was satisfied, I put my pack in, seated Cyverdon, and climbed into the pilot seat. 2 days after the storm, the snow moss was beginning to show again, sweeps of pale green with darker threads here and there. After 2 more hours we flew over a line of hills, and the green darkened dramatically, lined and irregularly veined in a dozen shades like malachite. In some places the moss was smeared and trampled by the creatures that grazed on it, herds of long-haired bove making their way southward as spring advanced. And along those paths, on the edges here and there, ice devils lay in carefully tunnelled lairs, waiting for a bove to put a foot wrong so they could drag it down. I saw no trace of them, but even the herders who lived their lives following the bove couldn't always tell when one was near. It was easy flying. Cyverdon sat half-lying and quiet beside me. How could she be alive? And how had she ended up here, now? It was beyond improbable. But improbable things happened. Nearly 1,000 years before Lieutenant Orne was even born, Cyverdon had captained a ship of her own, Sword of Naththas, and had lost it. Most of the human crew, including Cyverdon, had managed to get to an escape pod, but hers had never been found, that I had heard. Yet here she was. Someone must have found her relatively recently. She was lucky to be alive. I was 4 billion miles away when Cyverdon lost her ship. I was patrolling a city of glass and polished red stone, silent but for the sound of my own feet and the conversation of my lieutenants, and occasionally me trying my voices against the echoing pentagonal plazas. Falls of flowers, red and yellow and blue, draped the walls surrounding houses with five-sided courtyards. The flowers were wilting. No one dared walk the streets except me and my officers. Everyone knew the likely fate of any person placed under arrest. Instead, they huddled in their houses, waiting for what would come next, wincing or shuddering at the sound of a lieutenant laughing, or my singing. What trouble we'd run into, I and my lieutenants, had been sporadic. The Garsadai had put up only nominal resistance. Troop carriers had emptied. The swords and mercies were essentially on guard duty around the system. Representatives from the 5 zones of each of the 5 regions, 25 in all, speaking for the various moons, planets and stations in the Garsadai system, had surrendered in the name of their constituents, and were separately on their way to Sword of Amaat to meet Anaanda Mianaai, Lord of the Raj, and beg for the lives of their people. hence that frightened, silent city. In a narrow, diamond-shaped park, by a black granite monument inscribed with the five right actions and the name of the Ghazi Dai patron who had wished to impress them on the local residents, one of my lieutenants passed another and complained that this annexation had been disappointingly dull. 3 seconds later, I received a message from Captain Sivadin's sword of Nathas. The 3 Ghazi Dai electors she was carrying had killed 2 of her lieutenants and 12 of Sword of Nathas's ancillary segments. They had damaged the ship, cut conduits, breached the hull. Accompanying the report, a recording from Sword of Nathas. The gun that an ancillary segment saw irrefutably, but that according to Sword of Nathas's other sensors just didn't exist. A Ghazi Dai elector, against all expectations, surrounded by the gleaming silver of Ratcha Eye-style armour that only the ancillary's eyes could see, firing the gun, the bullet piercing the ancillary's armour, killing the segment, and with its eyes gone, the gun and armour flickering back into non-existence. All the electors had been searched before boarding, and Sword of Nathas should have been able to detect any weapon or shield-generating device or implant. And while Ratcha Eye-style armour had once been in common use in the region surrounding the Ratcha itself, those regions had been absorbed 1,000 years before. The Ghazi Dai didn't use it, didn't know how to make it, let alone how to use it. And even if they had, that gun and its bullet were flatly impossible. 3 people armed with such a gun, and armoured, could do a great deal of damage on a ship like Sword of Nathas, especially if even 1 Ghazi Dai could reach the engine, and if such a gun could pierce the engine's heat shield. Ratcha Eye warship engines burned star-hot, and a failed heat shield meant instant vaporization, an entire ship dissolved in a brief, bright flash. But there was nothing I could do. Nothing anyone could do. The message was nearly 4 hours old, a signal from the past, a ghost. The issue had been decided even before it had reached me. A harsh tone sounded, and a blue light blinked on the panel in front of me, beside the fuel indicator. An instant before, the indicator had read nearly full. Now, it read empty. The engine would shut down in a matter of minutes. Beside me, Sivadin sprawled, relaxed and quiet. I landed. The fuel tank had been rigged, in a way I hadn't detected. It seemed 3/4 full, but it wasn't, and the alarm that ought to have sounded when I'd used half of what I'd started with had been disconnected. I thought of the double deposit I certainly wouldn't see again, of the proprietor, so concerned that she might lose her valuable flyer. Of course there would be a transmitter, whether or not I triggered the emergency call. The proprietor wouldn't want to lose the flyer, just strand me alone in the middle of this plain of moss-streaked snow. I could call for help. I had disabled my communication implants, but I did have a handheld I could use. But we were very, very far from anyone who might be moved to send assistance. And even if help came, and came before the proprietor who clearly meant me no good, I wouldn't get where I was going, a matter of great importance to me. The air was -18 degrees. The breeze from the south, at approximately 8 kilometers per hour, implied snow sometime in the near future. Nothing serious if the morning's weather report could be trusted. My landing had left a green-edged smear of white in the snow moss, easily visible from the air. The terrain seemed gently hilly, though the hills we'd flown over were no longer visible. Had this been an ordinary emergency, the best course would have been to stay inside the flyer until help came. But this was not an ordinary emergency, and I did not expect rescue. Either they would come as soon as their transmitter told them we were grounded, prepared to murder, or they would wait. The rental had several other vehicles. The proprietor would likely not be inconvenienced if she waited even several weeks to retrieve her flyer. As she herself had said, no one would be surprised if a foreigner lost herself in the snow. I had 2 choices. I could wait here and hope to ambush anyone who came to murder and rob me, and take their transport. This would, of course, be futile in the event that they decided to wait for cold and hunger to do their job for them. Or I could pull Cyverdon out of the flyer, shoulder my pack, and walk. My intended destination was some 60 kilometres to the southeast. I could walk that in a day if I had to, ground and weather, and ice devils permitting, but I would be lucky if Cyverdon could do it in twice that time. And that, of course, would be futile if the proprietor decided not to wait, but to retrieve her flyer more or less immediately. Our trail through the moss-striated snow would be clear. They would need only to follow us and dispose of us. I would have lost any advantage of surprise I might have gained by hiding near the downed flyer. And I would be lucky if I found anything once I reached my destination. I had spent the past 19 years following the most tenuous of threads, weeks and months of searching or waiting, punctuated by moments like this, when success or even life hung on the toss of a coin. I had been lucky to come this far. I could not reasonably expect to go farther. A Ratcha-Eye would have tossed that coin, or more accurately, a handful of them, a dozen discs, each with its meaning and import, the pattern of their fall, a map of the universe as Amma'at willed it to be. Things happen the way they happen because the world is the way it is. Or as a Ratcha'ai would say, the universe is the shape of the gods. Amma'at, conceived of light, and conceiving of light also necessarily conceived of not light. And light and darkness sprang forth. This was the first emanation, Etrapa Bo. Light, darkness. The other three, implied and necessitated by that first, are Esk, Va, beginning, ending, Isa, Inu, movement, stillness, and Van, Iter, existence, non-existence. These four emanations variously split and recombine to create the universe. Everything that is emanates from Amma'at. The smallest, most seemingly insignificant event is part of an intricate whole, and to understand why one particular mote of dust falls in one particular path and lands in one particular location is to understand the will of Amma'at. There is no such thing as just a coincidence. Nothing happens by chance, but only according to the mind of God. Or so official Ratcha'ai orthodoxy teaches. I myself have never understood religion very well. It was never required that I should. And though the Ratcha'ai had made me, I was not Ratcha'ai. I knew and cared nothing about the will of the gods. I only knew that I would land where I myself had been cast, wherever that would be. I took my pack from the flyer, opened it, and removed an extra magazine, which I stowed inside my coat near my gun. I shouldered the pack, went around to the other side of the flyer, and opened the hatch there. Cyverdon, I said. She didn't move, only breathed a quiet, I took her arm and pulled, and she half slid, half stepped out into the snow. I had gotten this far by taking one step, and then another. I turned northeast, pulling Cyverdon along, and walked. Dr. Arila Spera Stragan, whose home I very much hoped I was walking toward, had been at one time a medic in private practice on Dras Anya Station, an aggregation of at least 5 different stations, one built onto another at the intersection of 2 dozen different routes, well outside Ratch territory. Nearly anything could end up there, given enough time, and in the course of her work, she had met a wide variety of people, with a wide variety of antecedents. She had been paid in currency, in favours, in antiques, in nearly anything that might imaginably be said to have value. I'd been there, seen the station and its convoluted interpenetrating layers, seen where Stragan had worked and lived, seen the things she'd left behind when one day, for no reason anyone seemed to know, she'd bought passage on 5 different ships and then disappeared. A case full of stringed instruments, only 3 of which I could name. 5 shells of icons, a dizzying array of gods and saints worked in wood, in shell, in gold. A dozen guns, each one carefully labelled with its station permit number. These were collections that had begun as single items, received in payment, sparking her curiosity. Strigan's lease had been paid in full for 150 years, and as a result, station authorities had left her apartment untouched. A bribe had gotten me in, to see the collection I had come for. A few five-sided tiles in colours still flower bright after 1,000 years. A shallow bowl, inscribed around its gilt edge in a language Strigan couldn't possibly have read. A flat plastic rectangle I knew was a voice recorder. At a touch, it produced laughter, voices speaking that same dead language. Small as it was, this had not been an easy collection to assemble. Ghar Sedai artifacts were scarce, because once Anaanda Mianai had realized the Ghar Sedai possessed the means to destroy Ratcha'ai ships and penetrate Ratcha'ai armor, she had ordered the utter destruction of Ghar Sed and its people. Those pentagonal plazas, the flowers, every living thing on every planet, moon, and station in the system, all gone. No one would ever live there again. No one would ever be permitted to forget what it meant to defy the Ratch. Had a patient given her, say, the bowl, and had that sent her looking for more information? And if one Ghar Sedai object had fetched up there, what else might have? Something a patient might have given her as payment, maybe not knowing what it was, or knowing and wanting desperately to be rid of it. Something that had led Strigan to flee, to disappear, leaving nearly everything she owned behind, perhaps. Something dangerous. Something she couldn't bring herself to destroy, to be rid of in the most efficient way possible. Something I wanted very badly. I wanted to get as far as we possibly could, as quickly as we possibly could, and so we walked for hours with only the briefest of stops when absolutely necessary. Though the day was clear and bright as it ever gets on Nilt, I felt blind in a way that I had thought I had learned to ignore by now. I had once had 20 bodies, 20 pairs of eyes and hundreds of others that I could access if I needed or desired it. Now I could only see in one direction, could only see the vast expanse behind me if I turned my head and blinded myself to what was in front of me. Usually I dealt with this by avoiding 2 open spaces, by making sure of just what was at my back, but here, that was impossible. My face burned, despite the very gentle breeze, then numbed. My hands and feet ached at first. I hadn't bought my gloves or boots with the intention of walking 60 kilometers in the cold, and then grew heavy and numb. I was fortunate I hadn't come in winter, when temperatures could be a great deal lower. Syverdon must have been just as cold, but she walked steadily as I pulled her along, step after apathetic step, feet dragging through the mossy snow, staring down, not complaining or even speaking at all. When the sun was nearly on the horizon, she shifted her shoulders just slightly and raised her head. "I know that song," she said.
"What?"
"That song you're humming."
Lazily she turned her head toward me, her face showing no anxiety or perplexity at all. I wondered if she had made any effort to conceal her accent. Likely not. On Kef as she was, she wouldn't care. Inside Raj territories, that accent declared her a member of a wealthy and influential house, someone who, after taking the aptitudes at 15, would have ended up with a prestigious assignment. Outside those territories, it was an easy shorthand for a villain, rich, corrupt, and callous, in 1,000 entertainments. The faint sound of a flyer reached us. I turned without stopping, searched the horizon and saw it, small and distant, flying low and slowly, following our trail, it seemed. It wasn't a rescue, I was sure. My toss had landed wrong, and now we were exposed and defenseless. We kept walking as the sound of the flyer grew nearer. We couldn't have outraced it even if Cyverdon hadn't begun to half-stumble, catching herself but clearly at the end of her endurance. If she was speaking unprompted, noticing anything around her, she was likely beginning to come down. I stopped, dropped her arm, and she came to a halt beside me. The flyer sailed over us, banked, and landed in our path, approximately 30 meters in front of us. Either they didn't have the means to shoot us from the air, or they didn't wish to. I shrugged off my pack and loosened the fastenings of my outer coat, the better to reach my gun. 4 people got out of the flyer. The owner I had rented from, 2 people I didn't recognize, and the person from the bar who had called me a tough little girl, and whom I had wanted to kill but had refrained from killing. I slid my hand into my coat and grasped the gun. My options were limited.
"Don't you have any common sense?" called the proprietor, when they were 15 meters away.
All 4 stopped.
"You stay with the flyer when it goes down so we can find you."
I looked at the person from the bar, saw her recognize me, and see that I recognized her. "In the bar I said that anyone who tried to rob me would die," I reminded her. She smirked. One of the people I didn't recognize produced a gun from somewhere on her person.
"We aren't gonna just try," she said.
I drew my gun and fired, hitting her in the face. She crumpled to the snow. Before the others could react, I shot the person from the bar, who likewise fell, and then the person beside her, all 3, in quick succession, taking less than 1 second. The proprietor swore and turned to flee. I shot her in the back, and she took 3 steps, and then fell.
"I'm cold,"
said Cyverdon beside me, placid and heedless. They had left the flyer unguarded, all 4 approaching me. Foolish. The whole venture had been foolish, undertaken without any sort of serious planning, it seemed. I had only to load Cyverdon and my pack into their flyer and be off. The residence of Arilla Spera Strigan was barely visible from the air, only a circle slightly more than 35 meters in diameter, within which the snow moss was perceptibly lighter and thinner. I brought the flyer down outside the circle, and waited a moment to assess the situation. From this angle, it was obvious there were buildings, 2 of them, snow-covered mounds. It might have been an unoccupied herding camp, but if I could trust my information, it was not. There was no sign of a wall or fence, but I would make no assumptions about her security. After consideration, I opened the hatch on the flyer and got out, pulling Cyverdon out behind me. We walked slowly to the line where the snow changed, Cyverdon stopping when I stopped. She stood incuriously, staring straight ahead. Beyond this, I had not been able to plan.
"Strigan!"
I called, and waited. But no answer came. I left Cyverdon standing where she was and walked the circumference of the circle. The entrances of the 2 snow-mounded buildings seemed oddly shadowed, and I stopped and looked again. Both hung open, dark beyond. Buildings like these would probably have double-doored entrances, like an airlock to keep warm air inside, but I didn't think anyone would leave either door hanging ajar. Either Strigan had security in place, or she did not. I stepped over the line, into the circle. Nothing happened. The doors were open, both inner and outer, and there were no lights. One of the buildings was just as cold inside as out. I presumed that when I found a light, I would discover it was used for storage, filled with tools and sealed packages of food and fuel. The other was 2 degrees Celsius inside. I guessed that it had been heated until relatively recently. Living quarters, evidently.
"Strigan!"
I called into the darkness. But the way my voice echoed back told me the building was likely unoccupied. Outside again, I found the marks where her flyer had sat. She was gone then, and the open doors and the darkness were a message for whoever would come. For me. I had no means to discover where she'd gone. I looked up at the empty sky and down again at the imprint of the flyer. I stood there a while, looking at that empty space. When I returned to Cyverdon, I found she'd lain down in the green-stained snow and gone to sleep. In the back of the flyer I found a lantern, a stove, a tent, and some bedding. I took the lantern into the building I presumed was living quarters and switched it on. Wide, light-coloured rugs covered the floor, and woven hangings the walls. These were blue and orange, and an eye-hurting green. Low benches, backless with cushions, lined the room. Beyond benches and the bright hangings, there was little else. A game board with counters, but the board had a pattern of holes I didn't recognize, and I didn't understand the distribution of the counters among the holes. I wondered whom Strigan played with. Perhaps the board was only decorative. It was finely carved, and the pieces brightly coloured. A wooden box sat on a table in a corner, a long oval with a carved, pierced lid, and three strings stretched tight across. The wood was pale gold with a waving, curling grain. The holes cut in the flat top were as uneven and intricate as the grain of the wood. It was a beautiful thing. I plucked a string, and it rang softly. Doors led to kitchen, bath, sleeping quarters, and what was obviously a small infirmary. I opened a cabinet door and found a neat stack of correctives. Each drawer I pulled out revealed instruments and medicines. She might have gone to a herding camp to tend to some emergency. But the lights and the heat being off, and those doors left open, argued otherwise. Barring a miracle, it was the end of 19 years of planning and effort. The house controls were behind a panel in the kitchen. I found the power supply in place, hooked it back in, and switched on the heat and the lights. Then I went out and got Cyverdon, and dragged her into the house. I made a pallet of blankets I found in Strigan's bedroom, then stripped Cyverdon and laid her on it, and covered her with more blankets. She didn't wake, and I used the time to search the house more thoroughly. The cabinets held plenty of food. A cup sat on a counter, a thin layer of greenish liquid glazing the bottom. Next to it sat a plain white bowl holding the last bits of a hunk of hard bread disintegrating into ice-rimmed water. It looked as though Strigan had left without cleaning up after a meal, leaving nearly everything behind. Food, medical supplies. I checked the bedroom, found warm clothes in good repair. She had left on short notice, not taking much. She knew what she had. Of course she did. That was why she'd fled to begin with. If she was not stupid, and I was quite certain she was not, she had gone the moment she realized what I was, and would keep going until she was as far from me as she could get. But where would that be? If I represented the power of the Ratch, and had found her even here, so distant from both Ratch space and her own home, where could she go that they would not ultimately find her? Surely she would realize that. But what other course would be open to her? Surely she would not be foolish enough to return. In the meantime, Cyverdon would be sick soon, unless I found Kef for her. I had no intention of doing that. And there was food here, and heat, and perhaps I could find something, some hint, some clue to what Strigan had been thinking in the moment she had thought the Ratch were coming for her and fled. Something that would tell me where she'd gone.